Thanks, Pat, and thanks to the whole PPMD staff for inviting me once again. So you can tell from my title, we're going to have quite a whirlwind of a discussion here, so just buckle in and we're going to zip along here. So I'm going to talk to you a bit about genetics of Duchenne, a bit about what the Duchenne Connect Registry is doing for us and can do for us heading into the future, and then also what we're doing to try to find novel targets for treating Duchenne muscular dystrophy through using genetics. So it's quite a flow. So my disclosure is I'm also a parent. This is a 12-year-old boy with a big personality, Dylan, who also has Duchenne muscular dystrophy. The human genome is vast. It's 3 billion bases long. It's quite difficult to wrap your head around. But at the end of the day, it's quite tractable. It's only 3 billion bases long. You only get one genome from your mother. You only get one genome from your father. And we can figure it out. In 2003, the human genome was largely first decoded for a cost of about $3 billion of our tax money. It took about 15 years to do. And that gave us the reference genome. We knew where every gene was. We knew what every gene was. And this is in contrast to when Lou Kunkel and his team in 1986 identified the Duchenne muscular dystrophy gene, which was one of the very first positionally cloned genes. I'll note that there's over 4,000 different Mendelian genetic diseases, like Duchenne, many of them much rarer, that scientists have now teased apart, and there's thousands more to discover, and we don't yet know the function of most of the genome yet. So, but we've now got very powerful techniques to jump into that, so I'm going to describe a bit of that and how we can use that for Duchenne. So the DMD gene, by its cloning and identification in 1986 and figuring out what the protein was in 1987, led to a profound revolution in how we go about doing diagnostics. We can do diagnosis better, we can do counseling better, we can do prenatal assessments, we can give people information that's very important. It also provided key insight into what Duchenne was. There was a wild debate. Many different possible mechanisms of the disease were under discussion in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And the one answer was that it's due to this shock absorber-like protein. It causes Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and it causes the allelic form that one of the cardiologists had mentioned, also Becker muscular dystrophy. Becker muscular dystrophy has a very wide range of severity, from people being actually virtually asymptomatic to being diagnosed in childhood, but with a slower progressive course. And we could figure out why they were different, which I'll explain in just a moment. It also suggested ways to go about doing therapeutic approaches, which came about very quickly. Gene therapy came onto the table, which is still being actively pursued. Exon skipping derives from this observation, this genetic observation, that Duchenne muscular dystrophy is genetically different than Becker's muscular dystrophy, but they're highly related. Utrophin upregulation is also found from genetic studies. There's many other potential such solutions that can come from genetics. And we've not yet delved into it, but we now have the tools to do that. So real quickly, this is a normal muscle. This is sort of the big view of what you'd see if we actually looked at a muscle. And in the little square down below where the blue is, if we looked at an individual muscle fiber, which is a single cell, which can have 1,000 different nuclei, which are the blue. If I do this, does that work? Well, okay. You're just gonna, I'll describe things as I go. I don't think I'll be able to point well. The blue dots on the upper part are the nuclei of the cell, but that's one cell. And then if I look at the top square then gets expanded down below, that's the membrane that's surrounding the one cell, and that's a muscle cell. And all the bits in the middle are the contractile apparatus and the signals that are sent for contracting the muscle. Then the blue square in the lower right is expanded further. And now we're looking at just the cell membrane, and this is a slide that many of the scientists show, and this is the dystrophin-associated glycoprotein complex, and a mouthful. But it's been used now over the course of 20 years to dissect what are the causes of many other forms of muscular dystrophy, which actually give us insights into how we can treat Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And Paul Martin gave us an example of that by studying the sugar modifications and over a dozen different sugar-modifying enzymes cause one other form of muscular dystrophy, and modifying those sugars may indeed be an important way that we can modify the disease process. The one part that we're most focused on is dystrophin, which I've just outlined in the black line here, and that one long filamentous protein acts like a shock absorber, The left-hand side binds inside the cell and binds to the actin, which is part of what's going to be part of the contractile apparatus. The outside part on the right binds to the near the membrane and helps to assemble this whole complex. So if dystrophin is missing, many of these other complex members are missing, and the membrane's very frail. So Duchenne muscular dystrophy, when it was originally identified, one of the shocking things about it was huge. It's one of the biggest genes in the human body. Out of the 3 billion letters in our whole genome, 2 million of them are dedicated to encoding just this one gene. It's on the X chromosome, which makes our boys particularly vulnerable to get Duchenne muscular dystrophy, so it's an X-linked recessive disease. It has 79 different exons, which is also huge. That's a lot of different parts of the gene, and these are glued together by the transcriptional machinery to make the mRNA, and the mRNA then makes the protein. So this is the diagram, and Steve Wilton was showing this to us yesterday for his very innovative approaches to trying to repair the gene with exon skipping. And in Duchenne muscular dystrophy, the thing that the genetics counselor will talk to you about and your doctors will talk to you about is that if the genetic mutation leads to an out-of-frame RNA, that's going to predict that the protein after the deletion. So here, this is an example of a deletion of exon 45 is missing. The edges of the exons don't go together perfectly, so that when the RNA is spliced together, everything past this point, exon 46 and on, is all normal at the DNA level, but completely abnormal at the RNA level and completely abnormal at the protein level, such that this end of the protein is not made at all. In contrast, Becker muscular dystrophy is a much more mild disease, and this huge deletion, missing a very large portion of the gene, can successfully splice between these two exons, the beginning of the gene that's binding actin and the end of the gene that's at the cell membrane are both expressed, and this provides a partially functional protein. And this explains what had clinically been observed for 50 years. What was the molecular basis of why Becker is more mild and Duchenne is more severe? And the answer is very simple. So at the bottom, dystrophin is completely absent, and that leads to the relatively more severe disease, Duchenne. Dystrophin is completely normal up above, and it's circling around the muscle. So this is a cross-section of a muscle. And dystrophin is reduced or somewhat dysfunctional for Becker muscular dystrophy. So one of the strategies is, of course, to try to make no dystrophin to be expressing some dystrophin. We know a lot about what mutations do and what mutations cause specific types of phenotypes. There's over 15,000 mutations reported in the Leiden database, which is a terrific resource, and multiple of the researchers here can help you guys navigate that resource. It's not so easy to navigate, but it's a tremendous set of data. So we know a lot about where mutations that are in frame sometimes still lead to severe disease, and where mutations that are out of frame almost always lead to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So in C and D, the key thing to just reiterate is Duchenne muscular dystrophy is due to out-of-frame mutations, and they might be big exonic deletions. That's most common. Big duplications, you get extra DNA. That's second most common. And then small point mutations that are causing splice site mutations, small insertions or deletions or nonsense mutations are the third most common category. If they're out of frame, they're generally leading to Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But if they're in frame or causing a very mild change to the protein structure, they can cause a more mild phenotype. Some of these variants are the actual mutation within the dystrophin gene causes differences in the spectrum of the disease that our boys have. This is an example of boys who tend to have a deletion in the later part of the gene tend to have more severe cognitive defects. These sorts of data we can gather over time with larger and larger numbers of mutations identified and tracking some of the very important phenotypes that the boys have. The typical way that Duchenne and Becker molecular diagnostics go is actually very straightforward, and almost all of us have been through this, is the current flow, thanks to the identification of the gene and molecular tools, is that blood sample is taken when this is suspected. DNA is tested, and it's tested in a very, kind of, to my mind, a very old-school approach, which is a PCR-based assay of all 79 exons to quantitate, do you have one copy, no copies, or two copies? So no copies is a deletion, two copies is a duplication, and you do this for all 79 exons. This is a very simple test, and actually gets the diagnosis completely right in about 80% of the cases. So that's step one. Some centers use comparative genomic hybridization, which is a bit more modern technique. If no mutation's found, then the gene, all 79 exons are sequenced to try to find a point mutation. A few percent of patients still don't have an adequate diagnosis, and actually, even though they have no dystrophin, still have a mutation. We can't find it through these techniques. But if there's no mutation, then a muscle biopsy is performed, and this is the normal, proper way that Duchenne would typically be diagnosed in this era. But there's shifts in that diagnostic process, and I'm going to walk you through what new technology is enabling at this point. It's very exciting, and we're using this for the project that Project Muscular Dystrophy is funding and sponsoring and actually empowering in a very practical way, as I'm hoping I'll enlist all of you to help empower as well. So before the gene was identified, the typical diagnostic process was history, physical, high CK, typical presentation, muscle biopsy, and that would confirm the diagnosis. Since the DMD gene was identified, DNA diagnostics predominate. But the current methods for molecular diagnosis are actually going to be able to push us to do diagnosis much, much earlier and much more precisely and gather information from across the genome. So the key technology that I'm going to describe for you is called whole exome analysis, where we can sequence all 20,000 protein coding bases in the genome simultaneously for very useful therapeutic processes. And this is a real clinical test that's already been launched at a variety of different places. It's not yet routine for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So the exome is that portion of your genome which encodes protein. So about 30 million bases, or about 1% of your genome, is used to make all the proteins in our body. That set is encoded within 240,000 exons of the genome, and that encodes 20,000 genes. Duchenne is one of them. It's one of the relatively largest. So on average, a gene has 12 exons. Within these 20,000. We can now take genomic DNA, capture all of the regions of the genome that are protein coding, and shotgun sequence them for a couple thousand dollars. So we can sequence the protein coding sequence of an individual's genome in a few weeks for 1/1,000,000th the cost of what the first genome did, and that's just 12 years later, and this technology is not being done moving forward. So this is launched as a clinical test. This is actually the requisition at UCLA, and I'm responsible for helping to launch this with a team of individuals at UCLA. Your doctor can actually order this test. Any individual with a rare genetic disease can have this test ordered, and this is actually implemented. It's billable, and actually insurance does reimburse this. So diagnosis for Duchenne muscular dystrophy is delayed. It's delayed in every single person with pretty rare exceptions. So the average age of parental concerns from surveys is a little under a year, 2 years of age, but the average age of diagnosis isn't for almost 3 years later. This has historically been the case, even in this molecular era, and even with pretty simple, relatively inexpensive diagnostic tools, like a simple CK blood test. It goes a long way to screening. So speech and language delays are a relatively common presentation leading to that initial parental concern, which is often not tied in and thought of as a possible risk factor for Duchenne muscular dystrophy and should be. So exome sequencing, when we're not saying it must be Duchenne, we're only going to sequence the DMD gene, has a profound role to play here. That is, as children are presenting with developmental delay or speech and language delays, those children can have exome sequencing done even if there's no known Duchenne in the family, to survey for all possible genes that might be causing that, which includes Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and this has actually been implemented. We can observe all of the common deletions and duplications and point mutations in the dystrophin gene reliably with this tool. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit now, so keep that in mind. So you've got one part that I want you to keep in mind is this exome sequencing. The next is the Duchenne Connect Registry data set, which is profoundly important. It's enormously useful, and it's in its infancy as well. And even being in its infancy, it's being quite useful. So Duchenne Connect, at the time that we started to look at the data, had about 2,000 registrants in August 2011, so that's the freeze. There's a good 50% more individuals within this data set. So this data set that we can look at currently is actually going to be quite a bit larger. We looked at about 1,057 individuals with Duchenne muscular dystrophy and with some information about when their child is either walking, what their age is, what medicines they've taken, and also at what age they lost ambulation or if they're still walking. So all of that information can be used to come up with a severity phenotype, which is how long are you walking. If you walk until age 18, you're relatively more mild than if you stop walking at the age of 8. Very simple. And this has been used for a variety of issues over the years. But we can intersect this with what vitamins are people taking, what supplements are people taking, what medicines are people taking, and are those medicine supplements making an impact on how the disease is progressing. So this is purely an online self-report registry information set. No doctors need be involved. And the very powerful part is that can then expand very quickly. So this 1,057 people are rather novel participants in medical research just by participating in a few hour survey online. What we've been able to look at is anything that people are doing mitigating the risk of losing ambulation. So this is a distribution of the set of 384 boys in this first set and the age at which they lost ambulation. So a subset of boys lost ambulation at age 6. An alternate set of boys are actually still walking out at age 20, which is quite unusual, but absolutely does happen. And some of these boys have no dystrophin on a muscle biopsy. It's a very clear diagnosis, and yet they're doing much more mildly than the typical Duchenne boy, who on average in this data set loses ambulation at around 10 to 10 and a half years of age. So by looking at some of this data, we can do multivariate analysis, control for all the factors, which is actually quite powerful to do. We can observe in the upper left-hand panel is the difference between the left-hand curve. These are two survival curves. So the further you move to the right, the longer it is that you're continuing to walk. And if the further the curve is to the left, the curve is shifted to losing ambulation earlier. The two curves on the left are either never having used steroids or past steroid user, and the curve on the right is current steroid users. And these data project that across the estimates that we can do with this Kaplan-Meier analysis, which is corrected for many of the other variables, there's about a three-year effect for loss of ambulation. What's interesting about this is we know that. We already knew that answer. We can see it here, but I did that with just a simple online self-report registry that Holly PA, Parent Project, and Ann Martin have empowered. That means that I have 1,057 patients with loss of ambulation data, and this is the largest data set that will ever be reported for Duchenne muscular dystrophy with those two combinations, and it was all done online. And we've only tapped into about 10% of the U.S. population. So there's a lot of work to do, and we should do it and fill these out and make that complete. The right-hand plot is the difference between prednisone and deflazacort. I know you can't see any of these things. The further right one is deflazacort, and there's a statistically significant difference in how long the boys are walking, but it's a subtle difference. The two lower plots are the differences between those on alternate day regimens or alternate non-daily doses, which there's a trend towards that behaving a slightly lower loss of ambulation or earlier loss of ambulation than the daily dosing, but it's not statistically significant from within these data. We can also then look at all the other supplements. So the most common other thing that people are doing is using vitamin D, calcium, and so I just rank ordered these by the frequency with which they're being used amongst the subset of 300 and so individuals who are currently using steroids who could be informative in this particular analysis. So we can start to look at issues about, are there some subset of the supplements that survive this multivariate analysis? And indeed, vitamin D and coenzyme Q appear to be having an ameliorating effect. There's others that are having a suggestive effect that are not reaching statistical significance, meaning more data would be more better, and we need more data. That's a theme in my lab, just by the way. So we need more participation in this to grow this data set so that we can all learn from each other. Duchenne Connect makes that possible to do, and it's powerful because we all fill out this immense amount of information which can be used to control the data in a way that's actually harder to do in controlled clinical trials or natural history studies in many ways. The final bit that I want to focus you on is that when we have this information, a subset of the children are losing ambulation at 6, 7, 8. Another subset of the kids are losing ambulation at 13, 14, 15, 16, and so on. What's different between those folks? So Pat had alluded to this. We don't know necessarily why those kids are doing much better or much worse. We do know that we can assess and look everywhere in the genome now. So we've launched a genetic modifier study, and we want this to continue to grow. And we're sequencing kids from the relatively severe end of the spectrum and the relatively mild end of the spectrum to search for rare mutations, rare variants that are potentially profoundly contributing and may give us novel therapeutic insights. You can participate either by going through Duchenne Connect, and you'll be able to find us there, or you can email either of these addresses. So the open question is, are any of these other 20,000 genes having mutations or rare variants that are making the disease worse or making the disease more severe? We know a lot of data from mouse studies. We know a little bit of data from human. So there's actually two reports published so far. One's from Beth McNally with Kevin Flanagan, indicating that common variants in LTBP4 may be modulating the disease process. Another is osteopontin, published by Eric Hoffman with Pegoraro. Both of these are leading to the thought of further therapeutic development. Melissa Spencer in our center had been long working on osteopontin as a therapeutic target. And indeed, these are having insights. And even though they may not be major factors, they're sufficient for us to think about them as therapeutic modulators, which may be relevant to virtually every child. So the open question is there anything else of the other 19,998? And can we look through those in a systematic way and in a powerful way? So exome sequencing is very complex. We look at 20,000 genes. At the end of the day, we find 200 genes that are damaged, that are damaging proteins. And it'll be true if I sequence everybody in this room. I will find 200 protein-damaging mutations in every one of us. That's normal. Figuring out which of these 200 damaging mutations are indeed profoundly important for Duchenne is then the next challenge. And to do that, we need to stack data up from multiple individuals on top of each other. I'm going to give you, don't take this data home as any real thought about what we're doing necessarily here in terms of this particularly being a meaningful variant, but this is an example of what we're searching for. So we sequenced two brothers, a relatively more severe brother, a relatively less severe brother. These two brothers with the same Duchenne mutation are having a different clinical course, and then we can search for what are the 200 mutations in the one boy who's more severe, and how do they look different than the 200 mutations in the brother who's relatively more mild. So this is an example of one variant that we can search for and find very reliably by searching through the 30 million bases. This is a variant in a gene AMPD1 where the more severe brother has a heterozygous, likely protein-damaging mutation. Other mutations in this gene lead to a metabolic myopathy. So is it possible that this child also has a subacute metabolic myopathy, and then the combination with the Duchenne mutation makes the disease process more severe? It's possible, and we'll need to do more to work and figure that out. So what we have to do to figure out if indeed a given gene is very important is we need to observe multiple independent rare variants in multiple boys. We need to stack that data up and find one gene that's repeatedly mutated in multiple boys that are severely affected, or conversely, multiple boys who are relatively mild. And then we'll learn what the rules are. Discordant sibling pairs are actually a very important resource here. So when boys are behaving very differently in a family, that's probably a core set where we can go at the genetics because they have exact same DMD mutation, and we should search for those boys very thoroughly. We hope to learn, and I think we will be able to learn, very rare potential solutions for how the body has naturally affected the Duchenne process, and then we can use those to profoundly develop novel therapies. This will be years into the making, but I think we need to start this process and do this well. So we may find new therapeutic leads, but also we may indeed find DNA variants that are predicting a somewhat different course, and this can actually be profoundly important for how we do clinical trials, for enrolling kids that all match together so that we can do those clinical trials more effectively heading into the future. So I just want to close by thanking very much Holly Pia and Ann Martin and some of my colleagues at UCLA who've made this possible in Parent Project. Thanks.
I think we're going to wait for questions at the end.